this is Ingrid.
I'm sorry about that mix-up.
That's all right. I'm just glad that you thought to call me, so I didn't...
I thought I had deleted the email. Thank God I found that. So anyway, I'm here.
Good. Absolutely great. How are you doing today? How's the...
Good. I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm well. And you said your daughter's visiting?
Well, actually, it's my daughter-in-law. She lives here, but she's had to, for her job, she's interviewing people for a job, and she didn't want to use her cell phone minute. So I said, well, come over here. I've got the upstairs line as a separate line. But when we plugged it in, apparently I plugged it into the downstairs line.
Okay.
So that's why it was busy. And I'm glad I realized that, because you'd have been very unhappy if I told you to call at a certain time and it was busy.
Yeah, I was just about to email you, but we are all good.
Okay.
Let me start off with just a lead statement here that it's we'll make it kind of official, and then we'll just get into talking about your experience at the 1968 Olympics.
Okay.
Today is Thursday, March 15th, 2012. This is Ingrid Cantola, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin and the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Katie Ball Condon over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Great. So let's just start with your basic biographical background, your birth name and where you were born and grew up.
Okay. I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, 1951. Grew up there my whole life. And tell me what else.
Did you... live, work, or, I mean, train and do everything right there in Jacksonville?
Yes, I did. Yep, I trained there. We started training year-round when I was about 12 years old. There was a group of about 8 swimmers that I think our parents realized that we were kind of a lot better than the average swimmers in the area. So our parents got together and hired a coach, and we started training all year round, which is what you have to do in swimming.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't do it a whole lot at that point. So, yeah, I lived there and trained there my whole swimming career.
So what age did you first start swimming?
I started swimming when I was 6, and I had an older brother and sister that swam on the swimming team at a local swimming club. So I just did it because they did it.
Awesome.
And, yeah.
And then what age was it? Were you when your parents hired that the coach for the
Small? I was probably about 12.
That's awesome. Had you participated in any other sports?
No, I never did. Mm-mm, I'm not too good on land. I'm not too good at running and jumping.
So besides your older brother and sister, did you have any other major influences to push you towards swimming?
Well, you know, I guess I just kind of fell into it. My father was a swimmer when he was in college, so I guess maybe that's why my brother and sister did it, or it was probably because we could ride our bicycles to the club where we swam, and they just did it because they can ride their bikes, and, you know, swimming's kind of a natural thing growing up in Florida, so it just kind of evolved that way.
Yeah. That sounds a lot like my experience with sport as well.
Really? What sport did you compete in?
Well, I did swimming as a kid, too, but then I moved into track and field in high school.
Oh, okay.
So what was your training schedule like once you had adopted the year-round coach?
Well, we in the beginning, we swam probably not every day in the winter as well. Now, in the summer, we'd swim twice a day.
Okay.
But in the winter, we probably maybe swam like 3 days a week during the week because pool availability was a problem.
Okay.
There aren't a whole lot of indoor pools in Florida. And you kind of need that because in North Florida, it gets cold, kind of like, you know, Austin probably gets cold some, too.
Yep, it does.
And probably when I was 14, I would think, we started swimming every morning before school. We, you know, start swimming at 5 or 5:30, swim for an hour and a half, and then go to school, and then we'd swim in the afternoon. So I guess from the time I was about 14, I was training every day. Usually we didn't swim on Sundays.
And did you also swim for your high school team? Did your high school have a team?
They did, and when I was in high school, it is when I really was swimming a lot. You know, I went to Europe and swam there, and so I didn't swim on the team and train with them, okay. But I would swim in the meets.
Okay.
And I couldn't swim in all of them because a lot of times I was gone or I was training for a indoor championship. And I couldn't go, but I think I swam in one state meet for them, and I think that's about all. So I just swam some.
Okay. And so when did you start, traveling internationally?
I turned 16 in London. So I would say when I was 15 and 16, I swam in South America. We went like it was more of a cultural exchange. And then they would take small U.S. teams to different meets in Europe. And so I did that. And I swam in 1966 in what they called the Little Olympics. It was a pre-Olympic thing in Mexico City.
Okay.
And the U.S. had a team, and I was on that team. Let's see, and then I swam in the Pan Am Games in 67. They were in Canada. So I guess that's really all the international traveling I did swimming.
And when was your first, U.S. national level meet?
I swam at the opening meet and the dedication of the Swimming Hall of Fame that's in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
And that was in December of 60. I had been 14 or 15, and I can't remember.
Okay.
If it was December of 65 or 66. I should be able to figure that out.
On my bio about you, it says it was December of 66.
And that's when it was.
Okay.
and they had people from, it was an international meet.
Okay.
And I won that. And I think that's probably the first time I swam against anybody. You know, there were some Russians. Oh, they're Russians, but there were West Germans and Sweden and France, and I can't remember, but it was a lot of top swimmers from around the world. And I think that was my first international competition, but it was here.
Okay.
And I think I set a world record. I'm not sure.
Yes, it looks like you did.
I think I did. Okay, and I think I guess that was my first one.
That's amazing.
Yes, it would be, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't that terrible? I can't remember, but it was a long time ago.
No, but that's an incredible accomplishment for you. Were, what, 15 years old when you started?
I think 15, yes.
Okay.
15, that's probably right.
That's fantastic. And so that was your first meet where you did super well, and then from there you started traveling more. Is that kind of how it went?
Yes, and I started going to, I probably went to my first U.S. championships when I was 14. And I got second in, I won the 100-yard breaststroke, and I think got second in the 200-yard breaststroke. So that would have been like March of, maybe 65. No, it had to have been 66. I can't remember. Maybe you have it written down somewhere. I don't know.
I have your American record for the 100 breast short course set in March 1967. Is that a little later? Is that a different one?
That's a different one.
Okay.
No, that might not have been a different one. That might have been I can't remember how many short course. I couldn't swim in one short course, and it may have been 60. No, that was 68 because I had mononucleosis, and I couldn't swim in that one. And that was 68 because that was the year of the Olympics. So
okay.
Maybe it was 67.
And so we're moving closer to the games here. So you were still living in Jacksonville, I assume?
Right, yes.
And so in 67 and 68 leading up to the games, what was your life like? How were you living?
Well, my life was swimming, and that was it.
Yeah.
That's what we trained, you know, before school, after school. And we were by now, this group of eight kids had maybe grown to 15, but we were all, most of us were on a national level. Like one of my good friends who swam butterfly, she was ranked like third in the nation. And then, so it really was a small group of really good swimmers. And, I don't know where I was going with that. What was our question? My life is really was just swimming. There wasn't time to do anything else. And, we swam and we always had a short course nationals in the, usually around March. And then the long course, championships were usually in August. So, you know, you're swimming for those meets, and then we would swim some meets in between, but not too many.
Okay.
Mostly training for those.
And so you're probably in between your sophomore and junior years of high school. Do you remember?
Sophomore, junior, and really, yeah, because when I was in the Olympics was my senior year in high school.
Okay. The question is, how was your training and competition supported? And, I mean, you're 17, so...
The same thing, with our parents were paying a coach.
Okay.
This small group of kids, we employed a coach. And I was lucky because if you won a national championship, which I did in my first short course championship, I think I won the... What did we say, the 100?
Mm-hmm.
I think I did. Yeah. If you were a returning national champion, the Amateur Athletic Union paid for your way to the championships, which was very helpful because they were in, let's see, Philadelphia and Lincoln, Nebraska, and Bartlesville, Oklahoma. They were all over. So that was very helpful as a returning champion that they paid your way. But if you didn't, you had to pay for your own way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it was supported. And things are so different now because so-called amateur athletes can accept money.
Yeah.
We couldn't accept anything. I was in a that 17 magazine did something on me before the Olympics.
Yeah.
They did it of other female athletes, too, that were going to be in the 68 Olympics. And 17 wanted to send me a gift, and it was a little bracelet. Well, they had to send it to New York to the United States Olympic Committee for them to approve whether I could accept this little teeny trinket.
Huh.
That maybe cost $10.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was so different.
Yeah.
You were on your own. You didn't get any help, like I said, unless you were on a national team, which, you know, in Europe, they paid for everything. And anywhere, of course, the Pan Am Games and the Olympic Games, everything's paid for. But otherwise, you got to pay your own way.
Yeah. And it's especially challenging when it's, you know, a parent who has two other kids to support as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It can get expensive if you're on that level.
Yeah. How would you say your training affected your schooling and your, you know, relationships with friends? And
Well, it did. I had friends, but I never could do what they were doing. I don't think I went to one high school football game.
Oh.
I didn't go to a high school prom. I did get asked one year, but I didn't want to go because I don't like the guy. But only one time. I was either gone or training, and I loved training. I mean, I loved doing what I was doing, so I really didn't feel like I was missing out on a lot. because, you know, we had a group of friends. We were all, you know, we swam together, so I had friends, and we all did the same stuff. But school-wise, honestly, it probably made me more disciplined because I had so little time to do homework that I had a certain time I had to do it,
mm-hmm.
you know, before I swam, because when I got back from swimming, I was too tired to do anything. So that helped. And then my senior year, the Olympics were in October, so I never started my senior year. I started my senior year of high school in November.
Okay.
And the school was very nice. They forgave everything. They didn't make me make anything up, you know, because of the circumstances.
Yeah.
So they were very flexible and very nice about it.
Interesting. It's good to, you know, have that sort of support, considering.
Yeah, and you can't do it without that. I mean, they, you know, very supportive. If I, you know, was out of the country for a week or 10 days, you know, maybe they made me do a certain amount, but they really were very understanding, and I think they wanted to see me do well, so they helped as much as they could.
Absolutely. So leading into the Olympic Games, you had probably the Olympic trials.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the process of the Olympic trials? And
well, at the Olympic trials, you have to, there's a minimum standard, so you can't even enter them if you don't have a certain time. And that's for any national championship also. You can't just enter it. You have to have met a certain standard.
Okay.
And it was just like, kind of, I guess, like a national championship. It really was, because it was the same thing, but it was the Olympic trial. So for that reason, it's a little more nerve-wracking. There's a lot more pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we just trained for it like any other big swimming meet, and I was fortunate enough to do real well. I won the 100 and 200 breaststroke and set world records in both of them, so I had a good Olympic trials.
Yeah, sounds like it. Did your family and friends come to the trials to watch, or
no? Because my parents had I had, like I said, two older siblings. Well, they were both in college. They were
okay.
paying for college. They couldn't afford to come see me swim.
Okay.
The first time they ever saw me swim in international competition, other than they did go to Fort Lauderdale for that first meet.
Okay.
When I was 15. They went to the Olympics, and that was the first time they'd seen me really swim internationally.
Yeah, that's a good time for them to do it. How did your family and friends and your school, I mean, react when you found out that you were going to make it to the Olympics?
Well, quite honestly, it would have been a shock if I hadn't made it.
Okay.
I mean, you know, from the time I was 15, I held both world records in breaststroke, and nobody ever beat me.
Okay.
So, I mean, I was supposed to make it, you know, it's just it was the next step. That's what, and I made it.
Yep. What was the reaction to you being so young and so highly successful?
Well, again, back then, most girls were my age. I mean, I was probably the median age on the team, on the Olympic team. We had one girl 13.
Really?
She was the youngest.
Wow.
And probably the oldest, 19 maybe, because there was, Title IX hadn't even been passed. I mean, this is when was Title IX, 1972? I can't remember, but after you graduated from high school, unless your AAU coach that was, you know, also coached to college or would let you keep swimming, girls didn't swim in college. They didn't have women swimming. Now,
okay.
it started probably right after the Olympics. They started getting, major schools started getting women swimming. But it wasn't available. So the fact that I was 17, I turned 17 when I was at the Olympics, was not a big deal. That was kind of the median age.
Okay. Interesting. I had no idea that there was so many young athletes at that time.
Yeah, I mean, simply because after high school, girls quit swimming.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
In preparations for going to Mexico City, did you change your training for the altitude that was coming?
Well, what happened was, once we made the team, I think the trials were in August, everybody went back to their home, and then we met in, we all flew to Colorado Springs.
Okay.
We lived there for a month and trained there because it's about the same altitude as Mexico City. So we would be used to the altitude and it wouldn't bother us. So we trained for a month, you know, as a team in Colorado Springs.
And was that the month right before you headed to Mexico City, or was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we went straight from Colorado Springs to Mexico City.
Did you have any other special preparations for heading to a city in Mexico? Was there anything that you guys took into consideration?
No, really there wasn't. The only thing we were told is, of course, not to drink the water.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also told that they would kind of, like, cater food for, like, the Americans and the British and the Canadians all ate in one cafeteria, and they tried to, you know, cook the food like we're used to cooking food. And, you know, the Russians and the Germans, and, you know, they had a cafeteria. So they really did try to make the food be as much like what we were used to.
Okay.
Which turned out to be my demise.
Okay, I was about to ask you a little bit more about that. So did you experience an illness with the food?
Well, what happened to me was swimming. Okay, we flew to Mexico City probably, I don't know, a week before the opening ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly. So then we started training in the actual Olympic pool. Well, opening ceremonies came, and swimming was at the end.
Okay.
It didn't start. It was probably at least 10 days into the games before swimming started.
Uh-huh.
And I would go in the cafeteria, and I would walk in, and immediately my stomach would turn. Just the smell. It almost made me gag. I couldn't eat the food. I'd go through the line, and I'd get the food, and I would go sit down. We'd all sit down to eat, and I would just sit there, and, you know, somebody would be sitting next to me, and some guy said, "Do you want this?" And I'd pass it to him. I could not eat the food. I couldn't. And I was surviving on Coke and crackers. So I think because swimming was at the end, I was thinking about this the other day in preparation of you calling. I can remember training in the pool at you know, the Olympic pool, and we were doing push-offs.
Mm-hmm.
That mean, you know, you didn't dive in. You were pushing off from the wall.
Yep.
And I was swimming at the 100 breaststroke, almost at my world record.
Yeah.
Just pushing off. So there is no doubt I was used to the altitude. That didn't bother me. I was in good shape. I had start training less and less the closer it gets to the meet, so you have more and more energy.
Yeah.
I was in great shape. But what killed me was the fact that I couldn't eat the food. And back then, I guess people think it's like it is now. Back then, nobody put us on the scales every day.
Yeah.
We had trainers. We had one trainer that if you had a sore muscle, you could, you know, they'd rub it for you. That was their idea of a trainer back then. Nobody kept up with us. Nobody, you know, it's just what we weren't monitored like they are now. I mean, now if that had happened, they would know within 48 hours that I'd lost weight. Why are you losing weight? And it would have been taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like that back then.
Yeah.
And so what happened to me is when the relay, I swam the 100 breast on the medley relay,
mm-hmm.
and we won, but I had a horrible split. So I got out of the water, and I went over to the coach, and I said, something is wrong with me. I feel horrible in the water. I don't know what it is. And so they took me in the back, and they weighed me, and I'd lost 12 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had absolutely no strength. I had, you know, messed up all my electrolytes and all the, you know, stuff that has to be, you know, top notch to
yeah.
compete at that level.
Yeah.
So they tried to pump me full of fluids. They took me to the hospital, and you know, they gave me IVs and all this stuff. But the next day, I had to swim the prelims of 100 breaths,
mm-hmm.
and I did terrible. I qualified like fifth.
Uh-huh.
So then you swim the semifinals because at 100, you have to swim it three times.
Yeah.
I swam the semifinals, and I don't think I did a whole lot better.
Huh.
And then in the finals, I was bleeding. Nobody was even close to me until about 20 meters from the end of the pool. And like I told my coach, somebody built a brick wall, and I ran into it. I absolutely had nothing left. So four girls went by me, and I got fifth.
Goodness.
So, and I hadn't been beaten in the 100 breast in 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So, for me, the Olympics were a very bittersweet experience.
Yeah.
So, anyway, got out of the pool, and, you know, what are you going to do? I didn't have the strength or anything. So I made the decision to withdraw from the 200. I didn't even swim the 200. I knew if I couldn't make 100, there was no way I was going to be able to swim a 200.
Yeah.
And I thought it wasn't fair to myself. I'm not going to get in there it's not the same level playing field. I mean, I don't mind losing. I lost a lot in my career, probably more than I won, because I swam from the time I was 6. But I wasn't going to do it, and I didn't do it, so... Unfortunately, that's how my career ended.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to swim 4 more years. I could have. I could have gone to Indiana or gone out to California, where a lot of the coaches that we knew also coached at college at that time, and they would have let me train.
Uh-huh.
But I had not. I just felt like I hadn't had a life. You know, at that point,
mm-hmm.
I was going to go to college the next year, so I decided, you know, not to swim 4 more years.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, my career ended on a rather sad note, but, you know, when I look back on it, not that many people have an Olympic gold medal, so I'm lucky to have what I have.
Absolutely. Can we, I love that entire, you know, your story is obviously very powerful, and your decision, you know, as a young person to pull yourself out of a race must have been incredibly hard. Can we talk kind of about your experience, you know, going to the opening ceremonies, and do you remember, you know, where you were in the formation of walking in and...
Yes. There are some of my teammates and other people have put on YouTube. You can go to it. You know, you can put in 1968 Olympics, and I can find myself. I was like in the fourth or fifth row from the front, because
yeah.
the girls were first and the guys were behind us. And it's just really, like I tell people, you know, I'd swum against all those people, just about all of them before, you know, in Europe and where I traveled, and you swim against them. But the Olympic Games is a whole different story. There is so much more pressure. There is, you know, you're an amateur athlete. This is it. There's nothing else for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have, you know, the Super Bowl every year. You don't have, they didn't have world championships back then like they do now.
Yeah.
But that was it. you didn't have anything else. So I really think, you know, there's a lot of pressure on today, obviously, but that was all you had, and you had to wait 4 more years if you wanted to try it again.
Yeah.
It was just, I don't know, it's a lot of pressure, and like, as I'm sure it is now, but it's just, it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
The whole feel of it, the whole experience, being with, you know, people from other countries, and you're in the, you know, you're in the lounges, and you're playing pool, and ping pong, and all that kind of stuff, and being with people from other cultures, and other countries, and like, especially for us, because, you know, there was all the communists, the Soviet bloc countries,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we had learned, you know, be afraid of them, and, you know, they're so different than us, and you kind of grow up feeling that way, but when you're around them, they're just people.
Yeah.
You know, they're just kids like you are, and they like to do the same kind of stuff, so, you know, in that way, you really get certainly a different perspective on people from around the world, because, you know, you realize, well, they're just like me. They like to do the same kind of things, and even though you couldn't, a lot of times we couldn't communicate, you end up being able to communicate, because,
yeah.
you know, you like to do the same kind of stuff, and, but as I was reading this, I really hadn't thought too much about the 68 games being really kind of, you know, all the stuff that was going on in the world at the time,
mm-hmm.
Really does make them kind of special, because I know outside of our the dorms where the women stayed, they had armed guards
mm-hmm.
all around the building, I guess, because they had student riots right before we all got there. So
yeah.
Had
you heard about those, the Tlatelolco local, I think is how it's pronounced, the massacre in Mexico City? Had you heard about that before you got there?
You know, I don't remember hearing about that in particular, but I do remember that there were student riots.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I remember. I don't remember any particulars of it.
Okay. Did you have any sort of reaction in hearing that there were riots going on there, or was it just kind of like, well, we'll be taken care of?
Well, it was more like we'll be taken care of, and you know, at 17, you really don't worry a whole lot about stuff like that.
Right.
Because you think nothing can happen to you.
Yeah. Did you remember hearing anything about the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the Harvard Crew Letter?
No, I've never even heard of that.
Okay. I guess it was, you know, another human rights project that was going on, and I think they probably targeted, you know, maybe people who were older and more involved in that sort of thing. In terms of your interaction with the other national teams, you said that you know, had heard things about the Soviet athletes. Did you have any, you know, stories that stand out in your recollection of interaction with any individuals, or...
You know, not really. My big deal was that an American woman had never held a world record in breaststroke.
Mm-hmm.
It was a European sport, and moreover, it was a Russian stroke. They were the breaststrokers.
Yeah.
So the one time when I went to Europe to swim, we swam in Germany, and the Russians were there. So that was the first time I had ever swum against her.
Yeah.
So I was so nervous, and you know, they're, you know, the Soviets, and she was this big girl, you know, real big shoulders, and she,
yeah,
kind of the stereotype you would picture Russian women looking like. So anyway, so that, to me, that was kind of funny, and I was scared to death, but I beat her.
Yeah. Do you remember this particular opponent's name?
Yeah, her name was Galina Prozamenchikova. I don't know how to spell it.
Okay, one more time then. What was her first name?
Galina, G-A-L-I-N-A.
Okay, and then
Prozamenchikova. And Google her, and if you get close, you'll probably come up with her. Put in Russian breaststrokers or something like that.
Okay.
And you can find out how to spell it.
Yeah. And so, what about any interactions with the East German athletes? Because this was the first games in which East Germany had sent a Olympic team.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't even remember an East German swimmer.
Okay.
They really did not do all that well. I mean, I don't even remember them meddling in anything. They may have, but I remember 4 years later, in 72, they won just about everything.
Yeah.
So I don't think they were that much of a force in swimming yet.
Okay.
But they certainly were 4 years later.
And you had kind of dabbled into this in terms of testing for banned and performance-enhancing substances. Did you personally receive any, or were you aware of the list of banned substances at the Olympics?
Yes, we were aware of the list of substances, and, you know, which really didn't, I don't think they told us, don't take cold medicine. I don't even remember that. But I do know I was tested, and I've never been tested before.
Okay.
In any need.
Yeah.
And one of the highlights of being on the 68 team was, I don't know if they still do this, but you got a chromosome test that guaranteed you were a female.
Yes.
That was interesting.
Yeah, that I feel like that was one of the first times they had ever done that.
It probably was. I thought so. I had a certificate that said I was a female, which I appreciated very much.
Yeah, I would too. How did you feel about that whole testing process? I mean, you say you appreciated getting your verification. Was it something that made you nervous?
No, we kind of laughed. We all laughed when they did the chromosome test, like, why are they even doing this? But then 4 years later, you understood why they were. I don't think we thought anything of it. We thought it was just kind of, you know, weird because we'd never had to do it before. And who was taking illegal substances? None of us were, so... Yeah.
Do you remember hearing about any other athletes or teams or nations that were... you know, coming
up positive? No, I really don't.
Okay. Were you aware, so you probably weren't aware of the disqualification of the Swedish pentathlete?
No.
Okay. That was just, I guess that happened midway through, he got disqualified.
Yeah, I don't even remember that.
Yeah. In terms of the U.S. team, were you close with your teammates? Was there anybody in particular?
Oh, we were very close, yes. My roommate, who I roomed with at the Olympics, we stayed very close friends. Uh-huh. It was Debbie Meyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're still good friends.
That's a familiar name to me because I'm from Sacramento. And
are you? Yeah.
As a swimmer in Sacramento, you know who Debbie Meyer is.
Oh, yes, you do.
And what were your accommodations like?
The accommodations were high-rise apartment buildings that were going to be low-income housing when we left.
Okay.
So not real good.
Yeah. So you said you had the opening ceremonies and then you had quite a bit of time before your event.
Yes.
Do you have any specific memories of the opening ceremonies, kind of going back to this one more time, of the opening ceremonies, like... How did you feel walking into the stadium?
Oh, yeah. Sort of my gosh. What a feeling. You know, here you are representing your nation, and the American flag is in front of you, and all these people are there yelling and screaming, and it's a fabulous experience.
That's amazing. I can't even begin to fathom what it would feel like to be on the floor of the stadium for one of those things.
It's really neat. And then, you know, you're there, and, you know, we don't really see the other athletes, American athletes, all that much. You know, because we're training all the time. Now, in the village, we might run into them, but, you know, we'd be going, oh, my gosh, there's so-and-so, you know, famous people from other sports.
Uh-huh.
You know, that we had never seen, and we were going, oh, my God, they're so-and-so. So we weren't all together except that one time.
Yeah.
So it was kind of neat, you know, seeing all the other athletes from the other sports.
Yeah, Definitely. I feel like that would probably be the highlight if
Yeah.
I was there too. So after your event and it, you did well for the relay, well enough to get the gold, and then 100 didn't go as planned and you pulled out for the 200. Did you have any more time left in Mexico City before you
I
went home?
did. I stayed until the end. I didn't do the closing ceremonies. I didn't go to those.
Okay.
I stayed. I think I stayed. My parents were there. I think I stayed with them that night.
Okay.
So I did not go to those, and that was my choice.
Yeah. Did you travel around Mexico City outside of the Olympic Village while you were there?
Not really. We had traveled. When I was there in '66 for the Little Olympics, they had taken us to a bullfight and done some sightseeing, but very little. And I don't remember leaving the Olympic Village when I was there.
Okay. And the swimming pool was right in the middle of it all.
Well, it was pretty far from the village because we
Oh.
had to take buses to go there.
Okay.
Yeah, the venues aren't in the village. I mean, they weren't then.
Okay. So what was that travel like?
It just put you on a bus and you'd travel 20 minutes to the pool, get off the bus, and we never saw anything else. Come
Okay.
back on the bus, they'd take you back.
Okay.
Not too exciting.
Yeah, and it's probably a little different now because it was the days before iPods, so
Yeah.
you didn't
And
like.
you got to remember, we're 13,
Yeah.
14, 15. We're children.
Yeah.
We're not Bea Torres, who's almost 40, who if she wants, she's in London, she wants to go see the crown jewels, she can.
Yeah.
It's so different.
So, did you have a lot of supervision from officials, or was it your coaches or your parents?
Well, we had team chaperones. We had two women who chaperoned all the girls.
Okay.
Made sure we were where we were supposed to be, put us on the bus, got us home, made sure we were all in our room, and they stayed with us.
Okay. And did your parents get to come in to the Olympic Village and see you, or did you mostly go out to see them?
They did not. No, I would go out to see them. I went, and I don't think I went to see them at their hotel until after I pulled out of the 200.
Okay. Did you, in terms of the media attention, did you have a lot of interaction with the media around your events? That is a pretty short, You did it till you were 17 and then pretty much stopped, right?
That's it.
So looking back on your time as a, short but highly successful swimmer, what would you say was your biggest influence throughout your athletic career?
That influenced me.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, maybe there was a person. I don't know if there was a person that influenced you. I just kind of fell into swimming because my older siblings did it, and I happened to be real good at it. They
Yeah.
were pretty good too. But I can't really. I can't really say. I don't think there's anything in particular that influenced me. It just kind of happened.
Yeah. You could also say that you were creating the influence for, millions of other young women swimmers in the future. So
Yeah.
you don't necessarily have to have somebody influence you when you're setting the stage for so many others.
Well, yeah, and really, truthfully, I was the first American woman to ever hold a world breaststroke record.
Yeah.
So maybe I paved the way for all the great American breaststrokers that have come since me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that you definitely set that standard for American
Well,
swimmers.
I n never thought about it like that, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It's hugely important to the entire, future of U.S. swimming. So,
Yeah.
if you could provide any advice for Olympic hopefuls in the future,
Say that again, I didn't hear you.
If you could provide any advice for Olympic hopefuls in the future, do you have any, you know, thing that you would say to Olympic hopefuls?
Well, you know, stupid things like work hard. I just really enjoy the experience and take advantage of everything it offers you now, because being in sports now, especially if you're at the top of your field or whatever, is so different. I mean, you can cash in monetarily, you get all this kind of, you know, you get a lot of publicity, you get, you know, and not just local, you get it nationally and internationally.
Yeah.
So it has changed so much, you know, from when I did it, that to me, you know, I could find myself saying, gosh, I wish I had all that offered to me. So my advice would be, take advantage of everything you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you say that the 68 games had a lasting impact on your life, or was it just kind of part of your journey?
No. It to this day has a lasting impact, because I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And what I should have achieved. But, you know, I think maybe that's helped me get through things in my life that have been hard,
yeah,
not pleasant, and didn't work out the way I thought they should, because, you know, I've been through it, and I see there's another side to just about everything you go through in life.
Yeah. That is a great takeaway, definitely, from that experience.
Wow.
Do you see the effect of the 68 games on the world, kind of the whole, you know, change in political tides around the Olympics with testing and things like that? Do you?
Well, you know, it has to be, and I never really thought about it. You know, you don't think about things like that when you're living it.
Yeah.
You know, I was just doing it. But you know, it had to have, and the change, that was kind of the change with black athletes becoming, you know, dominant in sports, and they hadn't been before. And, you know, I kind of saw that if you lived during that time, like when I went to the University of Florida, we had like mini student riot, not MANY, but MINI. And we'd be going to class, and they'd be throwing tear gas at them. And, of course, you know, we're all dressed up because we're the sorority girls, and we're just coughing. So, oh, I wish they'd quit throwing that tear gas. That, you know, gets in my eyes and ruins my makeup.
Yeah.
And we had hippies, you know, that lived on the, you know, the green area in the middle of the school and didn't wear shoes and didn't bathe. So, you know, it was such a diverse time, and people were doing so many different things, but I think, you know, you kind of came through that because we were exposed, and this is getting off on a whole other tangent, to black people. In my senior class, I had one black boy in my class.
Uh-huh.
In a public high school. So we were kind of mixed in with all that, and we were kind of the, you know, the first ones that, you know, we had friends that were black, and, you know, so it was really. But I think the Olympics was a big part of that because, you know, it mixed the black athletes and, you know, they did their black power thing. And it was a really unique time because so much was happening, but you're living it and you really don't realize it.
Yeah.
Especially if you're 17, you don't realize it.
Yeah.
So anyway.
For this oral history project that we're doing, do you... What are your thoughts about it? Do you find it to be, you know, what does it mean to you to
well,
be a part of
it? Well, my first reaction when I got the emails were, why in the world do they care about the 68 Olympics? You know, who cares about that? But then when Desiree sent me all the stuff on it, you know, I never really, oh, I didn't know you were here. Oh, okay. Okay, bye. I'm sorry. Okay, she sent me the literature on it, and I, you know, when I read about, you know, how it was the first time people were tested, and the Black Power thing, and the IOC, and all, you know, the Soviet countries, I really never had thought of it like that,
because
it was just the 68 games, and I was in them.
Yeah.
You know, I really hadn't thought past that. But, you know, I think they really were kind of a pivotal game, and it's just been a whole different ball game, so to speak, ever since then.
Yeah. The whole shape of international competition has just been rapidly shifted since then, I'd say.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm coming to a close with my specific questions. Is there
okay.
Are there any other stories or anything that you'd like to share or tell us about?
I can't think of anything. I just nothing like sitting next to George Foreman. Like I said, that's my claim to fame. Yeah. My kids think that's great.
That is pretty cool story, I'd say. Do you have any questions about this project for me?
I don't. I just, y'all are so nice to even care about us old people. We appreciate it so much.
No, absolutely. I'm very honored to be a part of this project myself, and I can't thank you enough for putting up with me and our little issues with the speaker. And
I'm so sorry about how I plugged the phone into the wrong outlet. It was busy. I'm so sorry. I obviously am not techno wise, as you can tell.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely no problem for us. There might be a chance that that Desiree wants to call you and talk about a few more questions that I might have missed when the recorder wasn't working.
Okay.
So she'll contact you if that's the case.
That's fine.
But again, thank you so very much for being generous with your time and with your story and all your memories. It's been a real pleasure getting to hear from you.
Well, thanks for doing it, Ingrid. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Take care. Bye.